Hello, salam alaikum, and welcome to Muslim Women Talk Ramadan. I'm your host, Shalina Jan Mohammed. I cannot believe that we are halfway through Ramadan. It's that familiar feeling which is the Ramadan paradox. It's going so fast, but it's also going so slow. As we're into the second set of days of Ramadan, I've been thinking about the fact that these 10 days are about maghfirah, forgiveness, and how to ask for forgiveness from Allah, but also to forgive myself and extend grace, and to make that not just a forgiveness of what's past, but an ongoing act of what I'm doing right now. Heck, I'm even worrying all the time about whether I'm even saying the right thing while I'm doing this introduction. Is it helpful? Is it not? Am I my harshest critic? And to some extent, it's okay. I want the quality of the work that we're doing together to be amazing. But I am trying harder now that we're in this stage of Ramadan to be more forgiving of myself in the moment. And I know that where I'm guiltiest of that is how I think of myself as a mum.
As my children are getting older, it becomes more about them and less about me and how I could make it special for them.
A bittersweet struggle.
You know, the things that I need to do for myself can get waylaid a lot.
Every little thing I do is an act of worship. So if I'm looking after my kids, act of worship.
Balancing it as a single mother, I'm just worried a little bit that I can't necessarily maintain that balance. And then therefore I have to, then I'll end up neglecting one or more of the three things I want to focus on, which is Ramadan, mothering, and work.
And the gap between how I see the picture-perfect mums and how I feel like I'm not really doing my job well enough as a mum is devastating. But it does push me to be more forgiving for myself. And that is also something I'm hoping to find in this community of sisters trying to get our way through Ramadan. So what have we got in store for you in this episode of Muslim Women Talk Ramadan? Well, we're going to check back in with the girls. I do hope that Iman and Hannah say something that's going to make my mum heart feel all wobbly and jelly-like. We are going to be talking to Henrietta Savati, who is helping us to get through Ramadan successfully, and she's going to be talking to us this week about self-respect. And then we have an incredibly inspiring conversation with Dr. Kiran Rahim, a paediatrician, about what Ramadan is like for her and what she is doing to make a difference in the world. First up, it's Hannah and Iman. Assalamu alaikum, my beloved daughters.
Alaikum assalam.
Gosh, Iman, you sounded like you're feeling the weight of the iftar coming. Is your mouth watering for iftar time?
Maybe.
Now, we are about halfway through Ramadan. How has the last week been for you, Hannah?
I think the last week's been going great, yeah. I've been enjoying experimenting things at iftar time, spending a lot of time with my friends.
And Iman, what about you? We're at the halfway point. How are you feeling?
Tough, but fun.
That does sound like a good summary of how things have been going. Now, Hannah, you, my dear 13-year-old teenage daughter, have been out having a rocking social life in Ramadan. I mean, much more of a social life than I've been having. Tell us what's been going on.
I've been going to a lot of other people's houses for iftar, and I think it's really great to like spend time with like other family members and just getting out of the house in the evenings, I think, is nice. Sadly, my madrasa has been like closed for the Ramadan, but like hopefully I'll be able to see all my Muslim friends at their house next week.
Now, thinking a bit more seriously, girls, Ramadan is considered in three parts. The first part, the 10 days, is rahmah, mercy. The second part is maghfirah, forgiveness. And the final is najat, safety from punishment in the hereafter. We have just come to the close of the rahmah period and we're into the middle. But I want to talk about rahmah. What do you think of when we talk about rahmah?
She's green and she has lots of leaves.
Okay, I think, Hannah, you might need to explain to people what that means.
A plant is called rahmah and she is green. And she does have leaves.
Apart from our plant, Rahma, who does fill our dining room with lots of mercy and oxygen and calming feelings, what do you have in your life that is Rahma?
Yeah, other than Rahma, like food, water, people.
School.
The community.
And being Muslim.
And girls, what dua would you like to do in Ramadan for children like you all around the world?
I think to make dua that everyone is able to have a nice iftar at the end of the day and have enough food to fill that up.
We do dua that all the children who are struggling and don't have the things we have get help, especially in Gaza.
I mean.
Thank you, girls. Let's begin that journey in the second half of Ramadan then. Do you know what? It's always such a joy to listen to Hannah and Iman and hear what they're saying. I'm glad we got the chance to do that. I will see you later, girls. Now, we are turning to our Ramadan BFF and help, Henrietta Sovati. In the first two episodes, we talked about mapping the road in Ramadan and how to exercise compassion, not just to other people, but to ourselves. I'm really looking forward to this week's conversation where Henrietta is going to talk to us about self-respect. Welcome and salam alaikum, Henrietta.
Wa alaikum salam.
In previous episodes, we talked about mapping our journey through Ramadan, and we also talked about how to develop compassion for ourselves and why that's important. Remind us why compassion is the foundation for the journey we're going on.
So the biggest marker, I think, is that compassion and perfection cannot be in the same space. And I think Ramadan is about moving away from the constantly chasing perfection. And by compassion, we bring the humanity of what we do and how we do it.
And what are you going to be talking to us about in this episode to build on that?
So because it's week three of Ramadan, and I think our ego has been rattled quite a bit by now, I think self-respect is one of the things that is really an important aspect of our journey in Ramadan, and learning that, building on compassion that we have already spoken of, and looking at the map that where we want to go, I think self-respect is an invaluable part of the journey.
I'm going to ask you an idiot 101 question, but that's what I'm here to ask. What is self-respect and how does it relate to Ramadan?
I want to make a distinction that self-respect, we're not talking about self-love or self-worth. It's very different. But self-respect is something that has been given to every human by birth, by God. It's part of dignity. It's an expression of dignity. It's an expression of how we were born. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is that with conditioning, we slowly get taught out of self-respect because we were not respected as children.
If we are in a state of lacking self-respect, how does that show up? Can you give us some examples of the ways that we can identify that we don't have self-respect and the negative consequences of that?
I think one of the things, because we are a community and we often go with, you know, we have big families, for example. I know Asian families, Arab families, they have extended families, big families. We get a sense of losing of what we like, who we are, what's important to us because of the sake of the collective. And sometimes it really taps into values. Some of the values are imposed on us instead of us being able to live our values.
That really resonates when we think about the way that Muslims are often brought up, and, you know, talking from my own experience, that qualities like being humble, being modest, being encouraged to be the bigger person in a difficult situation, even if that means giving up of yourself, and that very precarious teetering into the edge of is it arrogance or not, can easily, I feel like they can be easily confused with self-respect. So how do we untangle that sense that it's kind of been drummed into us that Muslims are modest and humble, which they should be, but also managing our self-respect?
There's a slight difference between arrogance and confidence. Because, again, I think I referred to it a couple of times in our series that we have got these two parts of us. One comes from a personality and one comes from a centered self. The confident self is always going to be centered, whereas the arrogant self is always coming from the personality. So we need to understand that when it comes to self-respect is the boundary between kind of walking of what we know of ourselves, of who we are, and we are not going against ourselves when there is a seemingly conflicting situation with the collective. And I think that's really where the human journey begins, as that we start walking towards each other with the help of compassion, of course, for ourselves and for others. But it's about understanding the very basic concept that I am okay, you are okay. So both of us are respected. Idea of boundaries come in, when to say yes and no, what is okay, what is not okay, what is acceptable. And this is a continuous negotiation that we do with human beings.
So what if you try to do that and then the other person pushes back and says, I'm your parent, I'm your elder, I'm a respected person, and pushes over your attempt to assert some self-respect?
I think that's a really tough one. And of course, every situation is individual, and it's we need to look at the complexity of the situation. However, I think the fundamental, and we know this in Islamic tradition, that there are certain things that cannot be imposed on you. One of them is that nobody can impose a spouse on you, for example. It's just not within anyone else's right to impose that you must marry this person. Because there is this idea of, I think, really, is the individual and the collective space has to be both respected. And we may not get to the agreement with each other, but the journey, the important part of the journey is to have this conversation. It's also very, very hard for people if you just imagine the basic idea of saying no. Most of us are very uncomfortable of saying no. Why? Why is that? Because we never learned how to say a wholehearted yes, and we feel guilty or we feel shame when we say no. So I think it's, again, for self-reflection, it's important that we understand what is my relationship with my yeses and what is my relationship with the noes.
The look on my face is not so much confusion. It's I can feel that knot in my stomach rising just imagining saying the word no, like that terror that you have to stand up for yourself.
Yes.
It's really scary.
It's scary and it's really hard. But as just like everything, we can learn and we can unlearn. And I think it's a journey of growing up. How do we become comfortable saying no? How do we say it in a graceful way? And how do we walk away from a situation where we said no, but without the guilt and the shame?
We're in Ramadan. Mm. How can that help us to assert the self-respect and find the right yeses and the right noes?
I think Ramadan is really an invitation. Because of the practice itself, you cannot scream and shout, you cannot use foul language, you cannot be disrespectful, but it doesn't take away the power that you can say no. Now, this is the time to learn how to do it respectfully and how to do it gracefully. It's that daily practice that you not train your mind to say no, you train your body, because it feels very uncomfortable. I remember the very first time I had to say no to my parents. I was 21 and I decided this is what I want to study, this is what I want to go. And to actually continuously doing this, it becomes easier. But I think as Muslims, this is the one thing I learned. As Muslims, we are asked to do this in a respectful way. Just because I am standing up for myself in the name of self-respect, I also have to be respectful to how I do it with other people. I don't want to be treated the same disrespectful way if I was disrespectful towards someone else.
So let's come back to the practicalities. And my question every episode to you is, give us some hacks. Nice, easy, small things we can do to kickstart this particular focus we have today around self-respect. Give us some exercises or observations, practices. What can I do that's easy in my life to build my self-respect up?
So I think probably, I don't know about you, but about week three, this is where my anger is coming.
Are you a hangry person?
Hangry and all sorts of ego-driven things.
I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, first week is wonderful and then you feel the height of it and it's relatively easy. But I think once you have broken down the fat and you have kind of got into the real nitty-gritty of fasting, is the tiredness is catching up and the food is, you have run out of your reserves of food. I think anger is a really great gift, and I say this with the greatest admiration for anger, because anger is always pointing us to something. So look at what makes you angry, but really look what makes you angry, who makes you angry, what are the situations that makes you angry, and just try to go a little bit beyond it, not just on the face value of, oh, this person is making me angry, and then we personalize it. No, I am angry and this is why this is making me angry. What is in me that is being triggered? What is it in me that gets so angry? Because it's very different when you say you make me angry and you do this to me, and then we develop hatred for the other person or the situation or whatever. But when you look at what is it in me that I need to take responsibility for, it will point you to your what's values. What is not being respected in this situation? That's what makes us angry, because something is being disrespected.
And I'll be honest, I was not expecting that final twist in the tale, that to build our self-respect, we have to unveil that anger and find out what our values are. Lots of things for us to talk about. I was going to use the Ramadan pun of lots of food for thought, but I won't do that. Lots for us to think about. You have given us a lot to ponder over, as usual, Henrietta, and we will see you in the next episode to continue our journey for Ramadan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, Henrietta gives us lots of food for thought about how we're going to map our road ahead, and this week how we're going to think about self-respect. And now we turn to our inspiring guest of the week to see how she does Ramadan behind the scenes and what impact she is doing. And I am thrilled that it is Dr. Kiran Rahim. She's a paediatrician and an NHS doctor, and she specialises in baby, child and adolescent health. She's also a mum and the co-founder of a new charity called Children Not Numbers, which helps children in war zones get the medical and legal help that they need. Welcome, Kiran.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you so much for having me.
So I'm going to start our conversation. Before I start, I have to say your scarf is looking very lovely. It's this bright colour with lots of little dots. People are going to have to check the video clip to find out. Thank you for cheering
up. I love a good polka dot. I'm obsessed with them.
So on that cheerful note, let's start with a quick fire quiz, a little bit more about your Ramadan.
Quick fire quiz!
So aside from dates, what are you breaking your fast with?
So in my house at the moment, everyone is pretty obsessed with this egg drop noodle soup that I make. It's like 10, 15 minutes. It's quite literally some soup with some dumplings in them. So we have them quite a lot at the moment because it's just nice. And by the end of the fast, we're feeling quite cold. I don't know if anyone else gets really cold, but I get freezing.
I have temperature regulation issues for sure. Are you working or are you taking time off?
No, I'm working. So I'm on a rota pattern, as my job indicates. I'm a paediatrician. So I'm doing a combination of long days, short days. I'll be doing nights next week, which are sometimes easier in Ramadan. But I'm definitely working. And then I have some time off for the last 10 days, alhamdulillah.
Do you like to pray at the mosque or at home?
So as a mother, I haven't had a luxury of praying in the masjid for a very long time, just because of having really young children and not really having the provisions in masjids locally, and also with my shift work. I like, to be honest with you, we have a really good prayer system at home. So every other day, my husband does Tarawih at home, and he leads me and the kids if they're awake. So we do Tarawih together, and I love that. It's the way I connect with him spiritually, but I also connect with God spiritually, and he will lead it for us. And then I also like doing my own Tarawih because I like to do my du'as and my sujood, which you can't really do in the masjid. I'm all about efficiency.
That's beautiful. What's the hardest thing about Ramadan?
So I think in general for me, it's sort of juggling the kids and work and home and trying to maintain some sort of spirit of Ramadan and the spirituality behind it. This year, I'm struggling with everything. I'm struggling with the privilege I have in terms of having a safe home over my head, the fact that my kids come home and tell me exactly what they'd like, and I'm able to provide that for them when so many in the world can't. I'm struggling with that.
And what's your favorite Ramadan activity?
Oh, I have to say it's praying Tarawih with my husband. Like, there's nothing that comes close to it. And I love standing next to him and him leading the prayer and just feeling like it's just us two, you know, in front of God. And this is a man I've chosen to spend my life with. So it reaffirms that for me every time we do it.
My goosebumps are definitely because it's cold in the studio and not for any other reason. So you're a paediatrician by profession. Yeah. And one of the big worries that mums and parents generally have in Ramadan is about ensuring that their children stay well. Do you have any top couple of tips or advice for parents to help their kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when it comes to Ramadan and children fasting, you just have to make sure, A, that they don't have any underlying healthcare conditions that could be affected by fasting. And if they do, it's really important that you seek medical advice on how children can fast. The fasts are a lot shorter now, so we can facilitate them a little bit better. So, you know, particularly children with things like asthma or diabetes, or if they've got an infection and needing antibiotics, those things need to be discussed. For children that don't have any underlying healthcare conditions and want to fast, fasting is a great way of, you know, teaching them lots of things like discipline. And as long as they eat the right foods in the evening and maintain their drinking habits, there's, you know, inshallah, it should be okay for them. And it's about eating the right things in the evening. So as much as children love like the pakoras and the samosas and stuff, it's not very good on a fasting stomach. So it's about making sure that you have a little bit of fruit, that you get some vegetables in, you get like a main meal, something carbohydrate based and protein based for them. So like, you know, like rice, like a bit of chicken or rice and a bit of fish or roti or whatever it is that you eat, wherever you come from in the world. So children are actually, alhamdulillah, very, very resilient. I wouldn't encourage very young kids to fast the entire month. That's too much. Maybe skip a fast and, you know, it's not ordained for them either. So I think when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you a grace, you take it.
I just realised by asking that question, which was very important, I've done a very typical mum thing, which is I'm thinking about the kids. But the question same applies to us as women. Mm-hmm. What should we be doing to look after ourselves in Ramadan, thinking particularly around mental health as well?
Yeah, so I think women just need to cut themselves some slack, really, because I think we're constantly told that, oh, you should be doing this, you have to do what works for your family. And all of us have very different family. Some of us have children with additional needs, additional sort of sensory needs. Some of us have children that have high level medical needs, and some of us don't have any of that. So you have to do what works for your family, and looking after yourself as well. So, you know, if you are somebody who's getting up very early and really struggling throughout the day, try and build a nap in if you can, even if it's for 20 minutes, half an hour, just to recharge after the
holy grail of the nap.
Yeah, absolutely, the holy grail of the nap. And then making sure you're not, Ramadan is not a time for me for excessiveness, right? And unfortunately in our communities it does become that way. Like, you know, the iftar sometimes becomes, I need to have 10 dishes, I need to have X, Y, and Z every day. And you don't. You need to look after yourself, and all of us need to remember that Ramadan is a time for attainment, becoming close to Allah, not becoming close to food. And so you can survive on one simple dish a day, and you don't need to slave yourself in the kitchen. And also it's about delegation, and women generally aren't very good at delegation or asking for help. Now, I'm very clear with my husband that I'm not doing iftar alone. I never do it. Like, we are both in the kitchen together. If I'm cooking something, he will be doing something else. If I'm making like the fruit stuff, he will be frying. And you need to ask for help. I also know that I come from a very privileged position when I say that, and not every household has men that do that, but you can definitely do that with your children and raising them to help you. You're not here to serve people. And I feel like a lot of women feel like their role in life is in servitude of others. And our worth sometimes is measured about how much we sacrifice ourselves for others. And I think that mentality really does have to change.
I was looking at a study which was done in the Middle East and North Africa about how men and women spend their time just before iftar. And it was really stark, because more men spend time using the internet and watching TV than they do cooking.
Yeah.
It's around 16% of men in those regions are cooking, whereas in their 20s are watching TV and using the internet. And it's 77% of women are cooking and men are reading Quran at 68%. So it is quite stark how those responsibilities are often shared out. My sense is that a lot of Muslim women and people generally are feeling stifled by the environment, the events of the world that are going on, and that they can't be their full selves, and they can't say what they want to, they can't do what they want to. But particularly in the workplace, where I think there is a sense of apprehension of, you know, will you lose your job? Will you create hostility? Is there a risk to you as an individual or to your job if you do speak up? Is that something that resonates with you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I am in a position where I speak to a lot of Muslim women, especially young Muslim women in sort of professional workspaces. And absolutely, there has been an increase in sort of scare tactics and in silencing Muslim women or anybody that's Muslim that speaks up about anything that is humanitarian related. I think there has been a very sort of clandestine drive to silence Muslim women in particular, you know, who have sort of a stance in society, if that is, or if they are visible on any sort of social or academic platform, which I think is absolutely horrendous. And there is a real sense in the Muslim world that, you know, other people can say whatever they want in the name of their religion or their political beliefs and nothing has happened. But if you're a Muslim and you speak up about anything that you think is wrong, the outcomes are very different for you than it would be, say, for a white colleague.
You expressed earlier something that I think a lot of people are feeling, particularly in Ramadan, which is we do have things here. We do have privileges. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always feel like we can do much to change what's happening in the world other than feel it in our hearts. And there's a kind of helplessness that comes with that. But you've decided that there is something you can do and that you're going to use what power you have. So, you know, I always ask myself the question is, what is it can I do in this situation? Mm-hmm. And you've embraced that. Tell us about your involvement with the charity Children Not Numbers and what that's about and what you're hoping to achieve with it.
Oh, thank you so much for introducing it. So Children Not Numbers, I'm one of the founding members of it. So it's a medico-legal charity that is essentially looking at supporting children in conflict zones and supporting them with their medical needs. So at the moment, we are working very closely in Palestine and we are medically evacuating children that need care that cannot be delivered in Palestine at the moment, in Gaza specifically. So we essentially get sent referrals from journalists, from whoever it is on the ground, from parents who reach out to us and say, you know, my child has an X condition or my child has been injured, this and this is what they have. We will get a group of doctors and lawyers together who will triage the case and decide whether we can offer the support locally or whether we need to evacuate that child. If the decision for evacuation is made, then we get the ball rolling from a medico-legal perspective to make sure, A, that child and family are safe. Guarded. We provide them with the medication that they need. We try and arrange their transport and then hopefully we get them into Egypt. And then from Egypt, we will arrange for them to go to the best care center that we can find, whether that's, you know, in the UAE, in Jordan or Qatar. We also support the medical team on grounds, but I think all of us, in whatever capacity, we all have scope for action and we all have a zone of influence. Now, my zone of influence is different to your zone of influence, and it will be different to my husband's zone of influence. But we all have something that we can change about what we don't like. And whether that's writing to your MP, attending vigils, writing to whoever it is in Parliament about your views, we all have things that we can do.
And finally, as we are approaching the second half of Ramadan and the latter days, and we have Eid coming, what is your dua for Ramadan and what is your hope for Eid?
I think my dua for Ramadan is that people across the world embrace humanity, and particularly here in the UK, that we realise we are all born equally and we all deserve freedom and to live freely and, you know, see our children grow and do all the things that we would want for ourselves, we should wish for others. And for Eid, I haven't even thought that far ahead. I think my dua for Eid is that we all remember the struggles of Ramadan and in particular the struggles our sort of fellow humans are going through in the world, and remember that Eid is not about dressing necessarily in the best clothes and you know, there is that element to it, but it's about community and coming together as a community. And I really hope that we can do that this Eid and unite and, you know, pray for a better world, but actually more important than prayer, try and action a better world in whatever capacity we can. And also obviously have a good time on Eid. Like, I mean, Eid is a time for celebration. So I will be spending it with my extended family. I imagine many people are. But yeah, it's very simple.
Dr. Kiran Rahim, we wish you all the blessings of the remainder of Ramadan, and may all your Ramadan and Eid du'as come true. Thank you for joining us.
Ameen, and thank you so much for having me.
Listening to Kiran, it feels so uplifting to think that there is always something that each of us can do, and we don't need to be stuck in a sea of helplessness, that each of us has the opportunity to impact the world and make the change. Well, what an episode that's been. We've talked to the girls about their Ramadan, we've talked about self-respect and how we can impact the world around us. I hope you found it as uplifting as I have. In next week's episode, we will be joined by Farzana Rahman, the founder of the Desi Doll Company, which many of us will have bought our Islamic toys for our children from. We'll be going on the final stage of our journey with Henrietta Savati, our Ramadan BFF, where she will be talking to us about kindness and how we apply that to ourselves. And we'll be getting ourselves ready with the girls for that final stage of Ramadan and the run-up to Eid. I'm Shalina Jan Mohammed. I've been your host for Muslim Women Talk Ramadan. See you next time.